So good evening, everyone. I was listening to this wonderful introduction and biography, and I thought, wow, who is that person? I might like to meet them. And I realized I didn't actually ask how long I have to speak.
We usually go to about 8:45, so that would be 48 minutes.
48 minutes, okay, we'll see. In my tradition, meaning from Kathy Fisher and before that from Maureen Stewart Roshi, we write out our talks. So I write them out, but then I start riffing on them, so I have to watch my time. Anyway, I titled this talk in my mind, Life and Death and the Genjo Koan. And always before I give a talk, I don't have any clue what I'm going to speak to or about, especially when I don't know all of you very well. Some of you I know. And I have to speak from then the truth of my life, because that's really what we have to offer each other, right? Or the truth, the vulnerability, the insights, everything that we are is a gift to each other. So from the Genjo Koan, firewood becomes ash. And it does not become firewood again. Yet do not suppose that ash is future and the firewood past. You should understand that firewood abides in the phenomenal expression of firewood, which fully includes past and future, and is independent of past and future. Ash abides in the phenomenal expression of ash, which fully includes future and past. Just as firewood does not become firewood again after it is ash, you do not return to birth after death. This being so, it is an established way in the Buddha Dharma to deny that birth turns into death. Accordingly, birth is understood as no birth. It is an unshakable teaching in Buddha's discourse that death does not turn into birth. Accordingly, death is understood as no death. Birth is an expression complete in this moment. Death is an expression complete in this moment. So as happens more frequently as we reach a certain age, I've been steeped in death this summer. A friend of mine passed away from cancer and I was with her. And then this last week, my cousin Jerry unexpectedly passed away. And it was within just a few days of the 7th anniversary of my mother's passing. I went up to Oregon to attend the funeral, to be with family, and his burial plot was in the Jewish part of the cemetery, right next to my parents. So both before and after his funeral, I sat there meditating at the gravesite of my father, who died many, many years ago, very young, and my mother. And it occurred to me, in this weird way, you know, we get born to parents and we don't think they ever had a life before we existed, right? Like their life started when we arrived. And it just occurred to me for the first time, really in some weird way, that they had had a life before I was born that I knew nothing about. I mean, I knew stories, but really, I wasn't there. I knew nothing about it. They hadn't known at some point that they were going to be a parent to a little girl named, that they would name Ami, right? And it struck me that that meant there was a time in this world where I as Ami didn't exist. And there will be a time where I as Ami won't exist in the future. So there's this famous blessing from Hakuin. Grandmother dies, mother dies. then I die. So it's kind of funny to think, like, why is that a blessing, right? That's part of the koan of that story of Hakuin. I mean, think about it. And I am thinking about it because the other thing that's happened is my daughter has come down with an illness that looks like it may be degenerative. And so there is a chance that I may be in this world again without her. And so this is a wonderful, deep practice of facing impermanence, uncertainty. And many years ago, my mother was diagnosed with a degenerative disease. We knew she would die of it, but of course we didn't have any idea if it would be a year or a decade or even longer, which, you know, when you think about it, it's actually the situation for every single one of us. We don't know. But often when we're given a fatal diagnosis, then the veil lifts and we realize, wow, this is true. I really don't know. And we then suddenly, poignantly, have to face the reality of impermanence. So my mom, I have to talk about my mom a little bit. She was always ahead of her time. Early on in my childhood, she became a health food nut and a vegetarian, which to us at that time just meant we no longer got steak and chicken dinners. And my mother also became a Zen Buddhist before I'd ever heard the term. She went off to this weird place called Green Gulch Farm and studied with Charlotte Selver. And when she came back, she brought this weird round black cushion called a zafu, put it up in her sewing room, and would disappear every day for a while. No idea what she was doing. So the truth is, I didn't really care very much at that time. My cousin Jerry was also ahead of his time. He had been born to two parents of the Holocaust, and he was very determined in his life not to pass on the trauma that had been passed on to him. There was not yet any term for intergenerational trauma. He became a psychologist who wrote decades before there was even a term for it about identity politics and cultural diversity, and he worked with Truth and Reconciliation Committee in South Africa and so on. So both are gone. And it still strikes me at times that I can't pick up the phone and call them. It's a very odd thing. Firewood becomes ash, and it does not become firewood again. Yet do not suppose that ash is future and firewood is past. So Dogen's life was shaken by death, as many of you might well know, at a very young age. His father died, I think, when he was 5 or 3. And about 5 years later, his mother died. And so I don't know how many of you have had parents die or had parents die when you were young. Or those of you who had children, you know that it's around 5 to 8 that it's very common for children to start asking about death, right? Like, what's going to happen to me? Am I going to die? Are you going to die? It's very, very persistently asked. And I can imagine, though, that what it's like to be Dogen, who lost both parents and became tormented by this impermanence, right? This question of impermanence. How do you live a life when everything is impermanent, right? How do we live this life when we begin to realize that nothing lasts, that everything's impermanent? And why do anything? What's the point? Where's the meaning? I mean, has this ever occurred to you? You know? Why love someone if they're just going to break your heart one way or the other? Why get involved when everybody dies? I just imagine Dogen losing something so deep it became his life's work to answer these kind of questions. How do you carry on in the face of this? So at 13, he was ordained as a Buddhist monk. And he thought if he learned to be a good Buddhist, that everything would be okay, right? Like if we just latch on to even being a good Buddhist. Everything will be fine. And because his uncle was some big Tendai official, he had access to the best teachers and the best monasteries and the best books. And he still wasn't satisfied. So off he went to China, where he felt sure that the source of Buddhism was. And by the way, back then, they didn't have Zen. They didn't call it Zen in China, right? They just had Buddhism. So everything was lumped together, and we studied Buddhism. There was no Zen exactly, I should say, and no Soto Zen exactly. It was just Buddha's words, Buddha's teachings, Dharma. So Dogen went to China, and he sat for 10 years, and he had an experience. And out of that experience, he came, returned to Japan, and began to teach. And in 1233, he wrote the Genjo Koan, which is an extraordinary encapsulation of his whole life's work of teachings. And it continues to be deeply studied to this day. In fact, this phrase, Genjo Koan, shows up throughout the whole collection of his teachings called Shobo Genzo, and I think it's something like 325 times. I don't know, has anyone here counted? It's a lot. And in a way, it's the kernel, like the quintessential core and question of his life work, and really of all our religious questioning, right? So we can tell how important it is just from this phrase of what Genjo Koan means. Like, what does this phrase Genjo Koan mean? And by the way, this fascicle was written for lay people. It was written as a gift to a lay person, which I love. You know, it was for us. Maybe he saw us coming with this crazy modern world in life. So how do we translate this phrase, Genjo Koan? The first translation I heard was the life koan. Like, what's the koan of your life? What is your life koan? And maybe if I were a great Zen master at this point, I just said, tell everybody, you know, I'd shove you all out the door and say, go live it. Right? But I have a little more talking to do. Or maybe as great master Oscar Wilde said, just be yourself. Everyone else is taken. So personally, I like the Okamura translation. Trying to study Dogen without actually knowing Japanese is challenging and maybe even a little bit sad, really, because every kanji, every character is so rich. So gen means to appear, to show, to be in the present moment. And it can also mean like something that appears that makes itself manifest, like the moon appearing from behind a cloud, or like someone who appears from out of a house. So in that way, it can mean manifestation or actualization. And then jo means to become complete, to accomplish. And genjo ko, as a verb, means then to manifest, to actualize. And as a noun, it means reality as it is in this present moment. Right? And then we have this word koan. So how many of you have heard this word koan before? Huh? Never. Good. Good. I can, thank you. Now I can explain it. I don't believe you. So ko means public. And in this context, what it refers to that's fascinating to me is that two people approach a government official, and the government official is supposed to treat them equally, even if they're of different status, right? And I love that because in this sense it has this meaning to equalize inequality of the beings in our messy, you know, world of human discrimination, basically. Right? And then the next character of the word koan is a problem because it has two very different meanings. The on means, as the way Dogen wrote it out, is an alternative character that means keeping one's lot. And I like to think of it as like staying in one's place, keeping one's place. And this refers to the individuality of people. So we have this word that means really co-equality, the equality of everything, right? And then we have this word on that means staying in your place or being in your place, which means you, right? Your individuality, your particular makeup, your personality traits. So it's this equalizing the unequal, or the meeting of difference and unity, or the meeting of sameness and difference, of emptiness and form, right? The two sides of the coin that always go together. The sense that this universe is only one vast universe. It is, and yet within that, when we look at the universe, we see horses and donkeys, right? People and dolphins, birth and death. Each and every one of these multitude of appearances that comes complete with its own unique particularity. So it sounds really philosophical, but I don't think it is, because I really feel that each one of us is living at this intersection of equality and inequality. And that the apparent duality is actually this sacred tension that we live with, because we are, each one of us is, both the universal, right, and the individuality. There's this quality both of taking our fate into our own hands and an equal quality of surrender into this great mysterious vastness. I like to think of it, surrender, almost as an entrustment, right? A release, a letting go. And when we say form is emptiness, emptiness is form, even that is two separate. So this is what Genjo Koan refers to. The question that true reality asks of us. So you can ask yourself, even in the midst of this daily life, what is the question that true reality asks of us? So it's Dogen's way of inviting us into this mysterious alchemy of the heart, of our deep curiosity and our profound longing, really. So maybe Dogen's question could be, how do we see and accept and love all these human beings who are so annoying, right? Like trying to get back from Davis today. Such an annoying person who drove 25 miles an hour in a 45-mile zone. How do we love them? I don't know. So how can we entrust ourselves to and within this unfolding reality? How do we become that intimate? How do we dare? And I think our awakening arises out of this. Loving these human beings and still seeing their Buddha nature and knowing that just as saying form is emptiness, emptiness is form, saying your Buddha nature and you with all your insecurities and pimples and feelings of not being good enough, no difference ever from the very beginning. Firewood becomes ash, and it does not become firewood again. Well, this seems true, right? I mean, if you're a kid like me, you went out camping. Anyone go out camping? Right? Or start a fire in a fireplace? And I was thinking about this. Like, you pick up a piece of wood, you put it in the fire, and start a fire, and sit under the stars roasting marshmallows and telling terrifying stories. And we don't really expect to wake up in the morning and come back to the fire pit and see the wood there again. Yet do not suppose that the ash is the future of the past firewood. You should understand that firewood abides in the phenomenal expression of firewood, which fully includes past and future, and is independent of past and future. Ash abides in the phenomenal expression of ash, which fully includes future and past. So don't think that firewood becomes the ash. Firewood has its own full, complete life. Ash has its own full, complete life. Both perfect. Just as firewood does not become firewood again, after it is ash, you do not return to birth after death. So I remembered my mother's cremation. Washing her body was really unexpected. It was offered to me from her community of Jewish women friends. I had not expected it. We hadn't talked about it. And I thought, why not? So we gathered together, and these women who had been trained in this very tenderly washed her body and invited me to participate. It was so powerful, so powerful. And they're singing prayers the whole time. Have any of you done this before? And then I put her rock suan, which came from Norman Fisher, her teacher. And we put her into the crematorium. And I chanted the Heart Sutra and Enmei Juku Kanin Gyo, honoring her full life, her complete life. Honoring her full ashes, her ashes complete, going in to the ocean where we offered them to water and fish, octopuses and squid. I also want to acknowledge something I'm not going to talk about, which is the deep philosophical questions of rebirth, reincarnation, who continues on. Is there life after death? If there's no self-existent self, who is it that's reborn? If I don't return to birth after death, who dies? Who lives, right? So these are questions that are, in fact, throughout many, many texts I've studied, including the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. But what I want to say is this question, when I think of my cousin, was something he really wrestled with. And I think that is our model. Truly, the Buddha over and over brought us back on ourself, right? He said, if we have a teaching, what do? Like, chew on it, test it in the fire, right? See if it melts. Bite it. Do you know about that? Have you heard this saying from the Buddha, right? If you know, he said, like, you bite it like gold? Because I guess I've never bitten gold. Has anyone done that? Like, given a big chunk of gold and you bite it. And you see, I guess if it's soft and you can bite into it, it's gold. So you're testing it for yourself, right? And you smelt it, and so you really thoroughly examine it. So it becomes yours. It's your question, and you test it. It doesn't matter. Philosophy doesn't matter. It's your life that matters, right? How do we live this life? This being so, it's an established way in Buddha Dharma to deny that birth turns into death. Accordingly, birth is understood as no birth. It is an unshakable teaching in Buddha's discourse that death does not turn into birth. Accordingly, death is understood as no birth. So we say something like this in Buddha's funerals, right? Speaking of no birth and no death. And it's also the Heart Sutra. And it's also the eight extremes of the early Buddhism, especially in the early Indian Buddhist tradition, where when we see, we look deeply into the nature of reality, that there is no birth, no death. Sometimes it's called not arising and not ceasing, right? We can't come down on one side or the other. It's non-dual. And it's a non-duality that we realize through our Zazen practice, that we are actualizing through our Zazen practice, this actualizing us through our Zazen practice, and is never apart from our Zazen practice. Not coming, not going, not existent and non-existent, not one and not many. And so he's speaking here of a very established Buddhist teacher. This is why he says, this being so, it is an established way in Buddha Dharma. It's speaking to this. Birth is an expression complete in this moment. Death is an expression complete in this moment. They are like winter and spring. We don't call winter the beginning of spring, nor summer the end of spring. So again, I really love Buddha's philosophy. This is part of why I became a Buddha scholar back in my first incarnation. and part of why I love the real nuts and bolts of Abhidharma and Buddhist philosophy and so on. And so we could talk about all that. And we could talk about cause and effect and karma. But I think really my question over and over again is, how do you live your life as a practitioner? Right? What is it to be in this impossible situation of being a human being? How do we address the world's deep spiritual crisis that we're in right now, right? I don't think we can practice and teach apart from this anymore. We have climate crisis happening now, right? Where it's terrifying. We're in the midst of a climate crisis. We have social injustice. Every time I hear of someone being stopped in an airport, I travel a lot, and I hear these stories, and they're pulled out, and it breaks my heart, right? And that's just one of the many, many things that we can observe in this world. What does it mean to be in the midst of living and dying? What does it mean to be living as a human being complete in this moment in the midst of this broken world? So, birth is an expression complete in this moment. This moment. This moment. So I like to really amaze people by telling them how much I used to weigh. I think some of you know this already. Are you ready for it? A whopping 7 pounds and 2 ounces. So who are you? Are you the 5 or 7 or 10 pound baby, right? Or maybe the child who ran gleefully, nakedly down the street through the sprinklers? Or the teen sulking in your room, feeling misunderstood and alone? I don't know. That was me anyway. I don't know about any of you. So what is the thread of the self that runs through all of this? I mean, we all agree, right, that we have memories of childhood, that we have memories of a year ago. Does that exist now, right? So I want to say that 7-pound, 2-ounce baby that came into the world, complete in that moment. And we could say our lives in complete in this moment, full completeness. And I think this is pointing to, in part, that right now, this moment has a intense vividness and aliveness of pure potential that differentiates it from what happened yesterday or what's going to happen tomorrow. Because I puzzle over this, right? Like if we say the past didn't exist, the future doesn't exist, this moment doesn't exist. I mean, like, where do we catch it? Where does this moment end? Where does the next one start? Right? Why does this matter? And I was realizing that this moment, there is a can be a wholehearted presence, an invitation, a vulnerability, a rawness, a presence that has its own unique quality, a particular power and completeness to it. It's a Dharma gate. And it's a Dharma gate in a unique way where past and present isn't. It's a lived moment. And again, it's now, it's now, it's now, it's now, right? We can't enter the past. We can't enter it in the future. We can enter it now. So I have a question. Have you ever been dissatisfied with this moment?
Often?
Like you wanted it to be different? Right? Like maybe have you ever felt like, oh, you know, this moment isn't quite good enough. Or maybe I'm not quite good enough. Or this day isn't quite good enough. Like maybe this is a, you could call it a throwaway day. And if I just get through this day, maybe my real life can start. Maybe tomorrow I'll do what I really was going to do and really want to do it. And it'll be how I really am. And then maybe if, like, we just move to paradise, my life will be better. And I don't know why this reminds me of a friend who actually retired early. You know this person. He took all his money. He's German or Swiss. I think he's Swiss, actually. And he said, he told us this story. He said, he retired early and he thought, what do I really want to do now that I have all the money in the world and all the time in the world? And he thought, I want to, you know, I grew up in these cold mountains. Where does a Swiss person go? The tropics, right? Looking like Bahamas. I don't even know these places. What else is there? The Virgin Islands. And he just started, and he said it, island surfing. He did 6 months in the Bahamas, and then the weather changed, and he went on to his next island. And one morning he woke up, and he realized he had this thought, oh no, another beach. And then he looked out, and he thought, oh no, more beautiful women in bikinis, which is probably politically incorrect to say these days, but, you know. It's funny, if we're happy in a moment, we enjoy it. If we're happy for a few days, we're bored. Like, what happens next, right? So, note from our sponsor, life is samsara. Have you ever heard of this, right? I mean, we often think, what is samsara? We think of samsara as something we can get out of, get away from. Samsara being this world that's messy and broken and full of pain and suffering and old age and death and sickness, and it doesn't work. And I keep trying to make it work. I keep trying to think if I dance faster and do better or make more money, it's going to work. And yet, it doesn't. There's another koan where the student says, I'm reaching for the light. Please help me. I'm reaching for the light. Please help me. And the teacher says, forget about the light. Give me the reaching. Show me your reaching. So what would it be like for you if you felt that your life was really, truly complete in this moment? That right here, right now, in the midst of your broken world, you had the trust that this is it, that there is no other life waiting for you to live it, that this life that you are leading right now, that you are living, already has the deepest absolute meaning, and there is no other life holding out that meaning, that light. What if it were that this were your only moment or your last moment? And what if you had so much trust that you could give yourself and entrust yourself completely, fully to the mystery of it, knowing again that the wholeness, that the longing for the light is right there in your reaching? It might be a very different experience of this world, right? You might not be thinking anymore that it could be otherwise. That there is indeed, right here in this moment, an invitation to genuine happiness, unshakable peace, a wellspring of love that's flowing deeply, endlessly, spontaneously towards every single living being. It's already happening inside of you right now. And you're already being met by the world this way. And at the same time, I like to break the Zen teacher myth. There's a myth. I don't know. Maybe it doesn't exist anymore. Maybe it's just me and the way I grew up in the Zen world. That there's this time that you reach something called Zen teacher and your life is suddenly perfect, right? And free of insecurity or free of any messiness or any doubts, any flaws. It's more, I like to know that there is truly my, and I don't really know what it means to be a Zen master. I don't really even know what it means to be a Zen teacher yet. Maybe I never will. That's okay. We keep finding out moment by moment. But right now, my metaphor, there are enough gray hairs that I can use this. How many of you heard of weebles wobble but they don't fall down? Okay, how many of you have never heard of weebles wobble but they don't fall down? Seriously?
Never.
Okay.
Weebles?
Weebles wobble, right? Isn't it weebles wobble? Thank you. Weebles with a B.
Okay.
Okay. Not weevil. No. Okay, weebles are these things that when, as I said, off script, when we get these, when we were kids, I grew up without a TV, but we snuck out to other kids and watched TV at their house. Weebles wobble, I won't sing it, but they don't fall down, little jingle. And it was this punching bag that you would punch. And it was kind of plastic and bigger than you were often, right? Yeah? And then they're small. Yours was small. And you would punch it, but it was weighted at the bottom, and it would go over. And then, whoop, it would be back up again. And as a kid, it was the most fascinating thing, right? Then you would shove it over the other side, and it would come back up. And more, that's my metaphor right now. It's like, so how would you be if you really had this wellspring of genuine happiness and love and unshakable peace? How would it feel if you saw your usual unhappiness patterns coming and complaining and anxiety and met it with this radical self-acceptance and love and compassion and wisdom? And this term, radical acceptance, Tara Brach wrote a book that's fabulous. It's something that came to me years before somewhere in Zazen, that's how we meet our life, radical acceptance, whatever arises. My mom wasn't like that. Even before her diagnosis, she was kind of depressive and fatalistic. Okay, now, another quiz. Does everyone know Winnie the Pooh? Does anyone not know Winnie the Pooh? Okay, so everyone knows Eeyore, right? Eeyore. Right, Eeyore's the one, like, Kanga made him a new tail, and Eeyore says, "It's an awfully nice tail, Kanga." What does he say? "It's an awfully nice tail, Kanga. It's so much better than the rest of me." Right? Or Pooh said, "Are you finally happy, Eo? Or now that you have your new tail?" And he said, "No, I'm not happy. It's a nice tail, though." That was my mom. So, having worked in hospice, you know, being trained back in the day when we were doing Zen Center Hospice on Page Street, then I was hoping that this diagnosis would kind of shake her out of this. But over the years, I didn't see any change. And I would talk to Norman about this, Norman Fisher. And yeah, that's my mom. And he'd kind of say, "Yeah, it's your mom." And then after her 87th birthday, she lost, like, literally about the day after, she stopped being able to swallow. And they told her if she continued to eat and drink, there would be a time where she would aspirate and choke to death, which is not a pleasant death. So she very bravely decided to stop eating and drinking, just voluntarily, which you're allowed to do. And I stayed with her for the next 10 days and 10 nights, barely leaving her side, literally sleeping on a mat next to her. And over those 10 days and 10 nights, she called her family to her, and all of the brothers came. We all had a big, you know, heart-to-heart moment with her. Can still see the window in the August sun, bright and glaring, and us all gathered there in her room. And she said her goodbyes to us, and she had streams of visits and phone calls. She spent a lot of time on the phone with Norman Fisher. And people would be cheerful and comforting, and she didn't want that. She wanted something real. She wanted people to lean in close. She wanted that intimacy, that heart to heart. She wanted the speaking of small details with big meanings. She met with the rabbi, and wasn't the bad rabbi that came to mind in that instance was how she always said, "I'm a bad Jew." And then she became quiet. And for 4 or 5 days, we just listened to Dharma talks together, mainly to Norman. We listened to wonderful mantra music. And slowly, something happened. I watched this woman who had been restless, dissatisfied, unhappy, negative, and hopeless become glowing, truly grateful, stunningly grateful, happy. Even when she couldn't talk, her eyes were just radiating it. And people in the facility would come and sit in her room. And these were the same people who had done everything they could up to that point to avoid sitting in the room with my mother. I kind of feel myself so moved right now, you know, almost shaking with it. It just felt so miraculous and hopeful. And something that you could see, she'd hit that wellspring of genuine happiness that glowed through her and touched everybody who came around. And unlike the majority of people who are dying that I've been around, instead of her breath becoming more labored, it became more and more and more subtle and calm and quiet, and then stopped beautifully. And the room felt holy and sacred and sublime. And I leaned in close, listening. Had her breath stopped? Listening, did she still have something to teach me? And then that sense that that person who had been my mom was no more. It was just her physical body. The great mystery of firewood and ash. And yet what she left me was an amazing gift and teaching and invitation. I want to close with a poem, one of my favorite poems. It's called "Everything is Waiting for You" by David White. I mean, you can never hear it enough, right? Your great mistake is to act the drama as if you were alone, as if life were a progressive and cunning crime with no witness to the tiny hidden transgressions. To feel abandoned is to deny the intimacy of your surroundings. Surely even you, at times, have felt the grand array, the swelling presence, and the chorus crowding out your solo voice. You must note the way the soap dish enables you, or the window latch grants you freedom. Alertness is the hidden discipline of familiarity. The stairs are your mentor of things to come. The doors have always been there to frighten you and invite you. And the tiny speaker in the phone is your dream ladder to divinity. Put down the weight of your aloneness and ease into the conversation. The kettle is singing even as it pours you a drink. The cooking pots have left their arrogant aloofness and seen the good in you at last. All the birds and creatures of the world are unutterably themselves. Everything is waiting for you.